What does this word mean?
The front part of an elephant.
All right, so it's the front part of an elephant. Is that what it means, though?
Storage place.
Storage place, like what kind?
It could be luggage.
Or just general storage. All right. What else?
Sometimes we talk about sending a chunk letter.
Interesting. Okay. In terms of a trunk letter, do we know where that comes from? Does anybody know? Okay. Interesting. That makes sense. All right, what else? Anybody? Torso of a human. All right.
I thought the trunk letter was sort of like a general letter. Like sometimes it's, a member is leaving and they ask for a letter, but they don't know where they're going yet. It's not a specific letter, it's just this guy was here, he's a faithful member, receive him in the Lord.
So, those two ideas are not mutually exclusive, right? It's a general letter for you to carry in your trunk, like your briefcase or your suitcase that you carry when you move somewhere else so they'll know, all right? As time goes on, it loses the direct connection with the idea of the trunk, and then it just becomes a general letter, all right? So that totally makes sense and is very normal, right? Now, what's the connection between like a trunk letter and the part of an elephant? I myself don't know.
Okay. It's a holding place.
Holding place. Yeah.
And then a trunk can carry a letter.
Could be. Okay. You could technically stuff a letter into the trunk of an elephant or even the trunk of a human. Okay. All of this, the purpose of this is to recognize one thing, all right? How do you tell in any given sentence which one of these it is whenever you see the word trunk? It's always based on context. It's always based on the words around it, right? You can know when someone says, yeah, we use the axe and we hit it right in the bottom of the trunk, all right? Chances are they're going to be talking about a tree, all right? They could be talking about other things. They could be trying to open up a car because they lost their keys and so they're trying to. That's unlikely, though. You read wider context, it becomes clear. Okay, we're doing word studies, a lot of word studies right now. I want to talk about this. Because often, a word can point to a whole host of different things. Like we were talking about pit in the Old Testament, all right? Pit in the Old Testament and then pit in the New Testament last time, and we're going to get back to that today. In the Old Testament, pit can mean a lot of things. It could mean a cistern, all right? It could mean a hole that you might throw someone in. Of course, Jeremiah was thrown into a cistern, so it was actually both, right? But it can also be an equivalent to Sheol in the Old Testament. It is often used in parallel, especially later. And like David, for example, likes to put pit in parallel with Sheol, both being down, both potentially being places of the dead, okay? So whenever you're doing a word study, first thing you got to think of is always context, right? Always got to think about context. All right, that's point number one. Okay. Point number two. All right, this is something else we've already discussed. When you see the word hell, all right, when you see the word hell in the New or the Old Testament, We know now that this does not point necessarily to one thing, right? It's actually pointing to a number of different words. And this is not unusual for this particular word, right? This is actually something that can happen a lot in literally any translation from one language to another. This is not specific in any way, and really in terms of what we're doing as a intellectual activity of word study, is not peculiar to Bible study at all. It's the nature of things with language. And so what are some words, if anybody remembers, all right, that the English word hell sometimes points to that we've seen? Yeah. All right, so Gehenna. What else?
Hades.
All right.
Sheol.
Yep, that's one.
Lake of Fire.
Have we actually seen that? We actually have not seen that. Now, some people in English might equate the Lake of Fire with hell, but in terms of New Testament translations, we have actually not seen that. And as far as I know, you don't actually ever see that.
What about the pit?
Okay. I don't know. Do we? I don't actually think we've seen that one. Like in the Old Testament, where you've got Sheol with pit. All right. I actually don't recall if it ever equates hell and the pit. All right. Now, what's that?
Abyss.
Okay, abyss. All right. Abyss. Is abyss ever ultimately hell? All right. Is it ever called hell? Like in the New Testament, in the Old Testament, it is certainly not that I've ever seen. We're actually going to be talking about that today. How can we equate these? And the answer will be yes and no. In terms of the New Testament, let me think. In the New Testament, in terms of the abyss, it shows up in the Gospels, where the demons ask Jesus not to throw them into the abyss. All right. Where else does it show up? It shows up in Romans chapter 10, where Paul talks about the, this is where he's quoting from Deuteronomy, who shall go up to heaven to bring Christ down, or who shall go down to the abyss to bring Christ up. I don't think it's ever called hell, though that might be a place where it's called hell. In Revelation, I've never seen it translated as hell. It's always translated as either pit or bottomless pit. All right. So I don't think this one is, and I don't think this one is, but we do get multiple terms that are in English, in various languages, because this is Hebrew, this is a Greek, and this is Greek/Hebrew terms, okay? And so, if you're looking at English, how do you distinguish between these, all right? One thing I've been doing is I've just been, putting a bunch of data, giving it to you in a PDF so you can distinguish between those things. If, however, you're doing a word study and you want to do a word study that's not something that I've given you, what do you do? Ultimately, what you really should do, if at all possible, is try to do what we've done here, all right, and go from what is in English to what is behind it. Even if you don't know those languages, at least knowing that these particular passages have this particular word might be very helpful. And I was looking for a copy because I used to have one. And then I asked for Bill and Edward to see if they had one, and they don't. You've ever heard of Strong's Concordance or Strong's Exhaustive Concordance? Anybody ever heard of that? All right. This is an old tool that was actually made in 1890. I had to look up that date. I don't just know that date. Strong's Concordance. I used to own one, and whenever I was in high school, I used Strong's Concordance. Strong's Concordance was this guy named, last name Strong. I don't recall his first name. James Strong? Boom. Thank you. What Mr. Strong did, or Dr. Strong probably, because he was actually a teacher at a seminary, What Mr. or Dr. Strong did is he took every word in the King James Bible and created a concordance. All right? What a concordance is, when somebody makes one, is they will say, okay, I'm going to find every time the word house shows up in the Bible, and I'm going to write out all verses where house shows up. All right? An exhaustive concordance will do that with every single word. All right? And so back in the 1800s, before, you know, modern, for computers and modern publishing, that would have been a massive task, huge task. This must have taken him years to actually do this. But that's what he did. He came up with a concordance, an exhaustive concordance. And not only did he come up with an exhaustive concordance, he actually took this step where he said, and he assigned to every Hebrew and Greek word, all right, he assigned a individual number. And so in English, you could actually use Strong's concordance and Strong's numbers to actually get beyond the English and see the words behind it and can do this study. And so I say this because even now, Strong's numbers, you will often find this in software packages or online sites, all right, and you can like hover over a word or get information, and they'll say this is Strong's number, and it will actually point you to a word. It's this kind of activity that is really helpful when you're doing word studies. And so this is the kind of thing that we've been doing. We've been trying to, instead of focus on the English word, trying to group them by original language words. And that's really how you must ultimately do word studies. Sometimes at the end of it, you come along and say, okay, well, these two Greek and or Hebrew words, all right, are translated as word X in English, and they should be, because they do actually mean the same thing. Sometimes that is what should happen and what is normal, all right? And so generally speaking, translators, they know what's going on. When they're equating things, they probably really do believe those things should be equated, all right? That doesn't mean they're right, but it does mean that they should be equated. Generally speaking, that's going to be the case. Yeah.
35 years to compile
this concordance. You did? 35 years. There's a lot of words, right? A lot of words in the King James Bible. So thank you, Jonathan. So step two, all right? The second thing I want you to think about is whenever you're doing a word study, even if you don't know the original languages, there are tools like Strong's numbers, if you ever see them, that will allow you to go from an English word and differentiate between the original language words. Yes, Bill.
There's a little Latin program called eSword. Pretty small. And there's a KJV version that has a plus symbol on it. If you click on that one, every word has a strong symbol on it. You just hover over it pretty quick and it'll take you to more.
Boom. Very useful. Strong's numbers. Yeah. Yes, Grady?
I was just going to say, I think Brother Hal said Young's concordance was for the young and Strong was for the strong. And I think one time he even found a typo in it. That was a major thing to find in Strong.
It's a big deal. Big deal. I mean, that thing's been, you know, used for so many years, you'd think they'd found most of them. So, generally speaking, if you find Strong's, it's useful. Now, Strong's definitions, if they haven't been updated, are probably out of date. But at least in terms of the numbering is super useful in terms of doing Bible study. So if you see, use something like eSword, you will often find them. And so I would recommend that you take advantage of that. Okay, that's the second thing I want to talk about. The third thing really takes us to Abyss and Sheol and what we've been discussing. So one difficulty you have, we're sort of like ratcheting up in difficulty here. First one is, if you have a general term in any language, you must know, based on context, what that term means. Words outside of context, generally speaking, don't mean much, right? Unless it happens to be a word that has only one meaning, right? Which happens, but really, you got to look at context. No. The second thing is, when you're dealing with a word study in a foreign language, then you ultimately should get beyond the translation and go to that language, all right? If you want to become, all right, if you want to become a Dostoevsky scholar, okay, what language should you learn? You really should learn Russian, all right? If you want to be a Shakespeare scholar, okay, what language should you learn? English, all right? But for us, it's not how we use English, so you're going to have to back up a number of hundred years, right, to really get into that. So it's not a foreign language. We have a huge advantage, but to back up, all right, we need to. If somebody, let's say, who was born in France, wanted to become a Shakespeare scholar, all right, should they just study Shakespeare in the language of French in translation? No, they should probably, if they really want to really be a Shakespeare scholar, they're going to need to learn English. And so depending on how much you want to dig into it, right, if I like Dostoevsky. I'm not interested enough in Dostoevsky to learn Russian just to read him in Russian, all right? So depends on, obviously, time and energy. But whenever you're doing word studies, you really do have to go beyond the translation to get what's behind. Often, just reading English translations, you'll see sometimes, well, they'll differ. Then you'll go, aha. But this is where something like Strong's numbers can help you. Third thing. And this is where you combine word studies with theology and Bible. And where you have some particular situation, let's call it the pit. Okay? Where in English we have the pit or bottomless pit, variants thereof. All right? How do we do an English study of this? And I bring this one up. All right, because every word study we've done so far has ultimately been successful in the sense of we do the word study, we find interesting things. This also allows me to talk about a word study I did a few weeks ago where it led to nothing really interesting. All right, and sometimes that is the result of your word studies. You will look and you will look for things and you go, I bet there's a connection here, and you will find nothing, and you will go, wow, that was a lot of wasted time. So let's talk about it. All right, the pit. Well, you've got, once again, we're contrasting Old Testament and New Testament. Because this leads to our third area of difficulty. When you're doing a word study in a foreign language, you need to get behind the translation to get to the foreign language, if at all possible. What happens if you're trying to do a word study across two different documents that were written in two separate foreign languages? This now becomes a further level of difficulty, and this is what we have here. For example, the word pit in Hebrew is the word, you would say it, bor. Okay? Bor. And looks like this in Hebrew. And Hebrew is a very different alphabet than English. Right? Bor. The word pit in the New Testament, at least when we talk about the pit in Luke, and we talk about it in Romans 10, and we talk about it in Revelation, is abyss. Okay? Which is just a transliteration of Greek into English. All right? Abyssos just turns into abyss. So it's not a translation. So the question is, and this is what went through my head when I was doing this word study, can I connect these things from a word study perspective? I wanted to see if I could. All right? So what would I do? What would be my methodology, do you think? Because they're different languages.
One thing I think, maybe we could try to look at the Septuagint and see if they translated that, how they translated that back then.
Okay, good call. So this is exactly what I did, and which exactly led me to nothing useful, all right? All right, so Septuagint, right? The Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. All right, started in the Hellenistic era and changed over time, but essentially that's what's going on. All right, so the Septuagint, does it ever translate this as abyss? The answer is no, it actually never does. It uses various different words, none of which are used relevantly in the New Testament. It's always words that are related to something that is deep and generally something that is wet. What I did find was interesting, and this is the rabbit hole, all right, that I went down, which ultimately led to interesting things, though nothing relevant, all right, was where is abysos? How is that used in the translation of the Old Testament? And it's actually used a lot, all right? And is used for what we would call, what you would often see in the Old Testament as the deep, all right? And so, like, for example, this shows up in Genesis 1 when it talks about the deep, all right? The abyss, all right? I looked through the entire Old Testament at every instance of this to look to see, okay, how often is it actually connected to Sheol, all right? And I found two instances, all right, two instances. But those weren't the kind where it was like Sheol is the abyss. It was, they were just related in the same sentence. All right, so there was no real connection between deep and abyss. What is, does anybody know, just from their English translations, what the deep is in the Old Testament?
The bottom of the sea.
Bottom of the sea, the source of fountains. All right, it, and I was surprised because, you know, you read your Old Testament, it's large, right? But when you do a word study, often you get to concentrate and see how often a word is used. The deep is basically the labeled as the source of fountains. And so where do fountains that you see on the surface of the earth, where do they get their water? Well, they get their water from the deep, all right? Which kind of makes sense. If you don't really know about the water table, though you kind of do, because, I mean, if you dig a well, you'll kind of find it. And so there's obviously, there's some deep water down there somewhere. That's the abyss. It is never, really, it is never related to Sheol in any significant way, which means from a word study perspective, this connection is ultimately fallacious, all right, which is disappointing because it would be super useful if it wasn't. And so if that's the case, now what do you do to connect pit, Old Testament bore, to New Testament abyss, if at all? Anybody have an idea?
Well, might see where Sheol in English occurs in the Old Testament and see what the Hebrew word was.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sheol in Hebrew is Sheol, right?
Compare the original translation of the word, so whatever the original Hebrew word is,
mm-hmm.
and the original abusos.
Mm-hmm. And they were never connected.
Oh, we already did that.
Yep, yeah, they were never connected. Ultimately, the king of all interpretation has to come in here. All right? The king of all interpretation is context. So, if you would, turn to the book of Revelation. So, Luke 8:31, Romans 10:7, and then all other instances of abyss are Revelation. Revelation 9:1, 9:2, 9:11, 11:7, 17:8, 20:1, and 23, all, I think, contextually pointing to the same thing in Revelation. And so it's not multiple different abysses. This is actually one abyss that shows up multiple times in the context of Revelation. All right. So if we start at Revelation chapter 9, all right, somebody read the first few verses there.
And the fifth angel blew the trumpet, and I saw a star that had fallen from heaven to the earth. And the key of the shaft of the abyss was given to him. And he opened the shaft of the abyss, and smoke went up through the shaft, like smoke from a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by smoke from the shaft. And out of the smoke, locusts came to the earth, and power was given to them, like the scorpions of the earth had power.
Okay, thank you. All right. Do we see anything there that can help us?
Like the abyss.
I mean, that's essentially what a pit is, right? It is a you dig a hole, all right, that's shaft-like into the ground. Yeah? Where do monsters come out of the abyss? Sure, here. Where does it say that monsters come out of the abyss in the Old Testament? Because this is ultimately what, if we want to connect, all right, the Old Testament to the New, which is not always possible, because there is new revelation in the New Testament, all right? And so sometimes it will not directly connect to anything in the Old Testament. Well, what's our goal? Our goal, to restate, is how do we connect, or can we, and the answer is yes, how do we connect abyss to the pit, or possibly Sheol? How would we do it? What we have here, all right, is we have the idea of something, a hole in the ground, which seems like it's probably connected to this. Probably, all right? But not necessarily. We haven't seen proof yet, I don't think. Leah?
I think it's kind of interesting that there's a key and it has to be open. So it's not, it doesn't sound just like a hole in the ground. Like,
yeah.
There's this, you have to enter by a special way, which makes it sound like Sheol to me, like you die and go there, or something like that.
Yeah.
It's not just a place anyone can get into. You have to get a key to get in.
Right. And so that, if we think about Sheol, all right, how do you get in? What's at the entrance place of Sheol? There is an idea of gates there, all right? And so that gets us closer, all right? This is not something you can trip and fall into. This is something that you must be led into. If it is Sheol, then everyone who dies is led in there. But it is something that has a gate and has the idea of locked. In this case, obviously the idea of imprisonment of some sort, all right? Okay. Okay. Similar ideas. Still, can we say for sure that these are the same thing? I don't think we can tell from Revelation 9, 1 and 2. Yeah.
Has the bottom to it, and at the bottom there's fire, magma, maybe?
Potentially. Something that generates smoke.
Making a lot of smoke.
Yeah.
So something's at the very bottom.
Yeah, I think if you... Yeah.
I don't think if you equate this to show with the grave.
Mm-hmm. So, bottomless... I do think bottomless here is an irresponsible translation. I do not think it should be, because there is no abyss with bottomless next to it as an adjective. All right. This is a translational choice, and I believe is a bad one, because it may or may not be bottomless. I have no reason to think it's bottomless. Yeah. Yeah.
In the King James Version, where it has bottom, it's pit, the marginal thing says pit of the abyss. That's the marginal.
Okay. Interesting. Pit of the abyss. It's just really abyss. All right, let's keep going, because we do see something, all right? And this is, once again, context. Context is swirling around the idea of equating, but really we don't have an equation yet between pit and Sheol here. If we keep going, let's, in verse 4, they were told, talking about the scorpions, not to harm the grass of the earth or any green plant or any tree, but only those who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. They were allowed to torment them for 5 months, but not to kill them. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings someone. And in those days, people will seek death and will not find it. They will long to die, but death will flee from them. At appearance, the locusts were like horses prepared for battle. On their heads were what looked like crowns of gold, and their faces were like human faces. Their hair like women's hair, and their teeth like lion's teeth. They had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the noise of their wings was like the noise of many chariots with horses rushing into battle. They have tails and stings like scorpions, and their power to hurt people for 5 months is in their tails. They have as king over them the angel of the bottomless pit, or just pit. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek he is called Apollyon. Okay? This right here makes our connection pretty firmly, I think. All right? Question is how? Verse 11 specifically. Read it. Does anybody recognize that name, Abaddon? Turn to Job 26. Job 26, starting in verse 1. Then Job answered and said, How have you helped him who has no power? How you have saved the arm that has no strength? How you have counseled him who has no wisdom and plentifully declared sound knowledge? With whose help have you uttered words, and whose breath has come out from you? The dead tremble under the waters and their inhabitants. Sheol is naked before God, and Abaddon has no covering. What's going on there in Job? What's the connection between Sheol and Abaddon? They both show up there in that verse, in verse 6. Right? Hebrew likes to put things in parallel. Now, when they're put in parallel, that doesn't necessarily mean they're equated. All right? But there is at very least a very strong connection between those ideas. All right? So here in Job, we do have a very, very strong correlation between Sheol and Abaddon. Sheol is naked before God, and Abaddon has no covering. All right, it doesn't really seem here's strong correlation. It really does seem total equation. They both have no covering. They are both naked before God. Okay, turn to Proverbs 15:11. Proverbs 15:11. Sheol and Abaddon lie open before the Lord. How much more the hearts of the children of man? All right. Point of the proverb is obviously God can see into the heart, right? Children of man, their minds, their inner ideas, they are not hidden from God. God, of course, God can see in man. God can even see in Sheol. God can even see in Abaddon. Much less into your mind. All right, your mind is much more open to God than this other dark place. So we've got another place where they're highly correlated. All right, let's look at Proverbs 27:20. And I think these are all the uses of Abaddon in the Old Testament. All right. And here I think is another place where I think you might as well call them equated. All right. Sheol and Abaddon are never satisfied, and never satisfied are the eyes of man. All right. Parallel. What is the proverbialist here trying to compare? When it says the eyes of man are never satisfied like Sheol, what's it talking about?
Everybody's going to die. It just keeps eating.
That's what it's talking about Sheol. What's it saying about man? I don't think so. I think it says something different.
Men are never satisfied. They're always
consuming. Right. It's about the greed of man, I think. So look at it again. Maybe I'm wrong. No, I think that's what it was saying here, right? Sheol and Abaddon are never satisfied, right? When is Sheol just going to be ready to stop taking dead people? It's not. It's just keep bringing in the dead, all right? When is a man's eyes ever satisfied? All right? Well, by nature, well, they're just always greedy, right? It's pointing to that, I think. Regardless, you've got, once again, Sheol and Abaddon. All right? Now, if we go back to Revelation, I mean, still, Revelation is not written in Hebrew. All right? What we have is we have Greek here. It still, notice what's going on here in verse 11. They have a king over them, the angel of the bottomless pit, and his name in Hebrew is Abaddon. And so, keep reading. And in Greek, his name is Apollyon. All right, what is the translation for Abaddon? It is Apollyon. But the author here in Revelation is explicitly trying by saying his name in Hebrew, and then he just transliterates. All right. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon or Abaddon. I'm actually not sure where to put the emphasis there. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon. And so what he'll do is he just puts in Greek letters roughly the same corresponding ones. It's a transliteration. Right. And so what you've got here, which happens sometimes in the New Testament. Right. What he's got is the author's here trying to make that link very clear, saying, if you know these places in the Old Testament where Abaddon is talked about, then you will know who this is. All right. This means, I think, all right, that if the abyss is not the same thing as Hades, all right, if they are not, okay, then they are highly correlated. They go together. They're brothers. They're pairs. All right. If they're not the same, all right, or they are the same. Either way, they are highly correlated. And so you should think about them as essentially the same place. Maybe when you get there, there's a slightly different place, all right, where in the Old Testament, I think the dead go there. In the New Testament, do the dead go there? Well, Jesus went there in Romans 10. In the other places in the New Testament, it's always a place for demons. Okay? It's always a place for demons. And if you think about the rest of the places in Revelation, think about them. It's what goes into the pit? Well, the scorpion demon things come out of the pit. What gets thrown into the pit later? And Satan gets thrown, the serpent gets thrown into the pit. So once again, a place for demonic spiritual entities. And same thing from Luke, right? These are demons who are saying, please don't cast us into the pit. It's a prison idea. Sheol, all right, also like a prison idea. So this is ultimately how you have to connect them. You can't connect these from a word study perspective directly based on the words themselves. You have to see where Abaddon, all right, is linked with Sheol. And that's how you make ultimately this connection here. Word studies are hard, sometimes useful if you really want to make the connections. And this is, of course, where commentaries will often come in very helpful, because the commentaries will have, generally speaking, have done a lot of this homework, or at least good commentaries will. They will do a lot of these word studies because it's very normal to do this kind of thing, to try to connect. Because one thing you should be doing anytime you're reading the New Testament is you should be thinking about what are the Old Testament antecedents to these ideas. All right. Sometimes, like I said, you will find no antecedents because it is something that is truly new in the New Testament because of progressive revelation. All right. But often you will find them. And this one's a hard one to find. All right. So because of this specific verse, it's not too hard to make this link anymore. But it really, without that verse, it's hard to make the link. Yes, Leah.
Very negative.
Mm-hmm.
But in my mind, I felt like it was maybe different than Sheol because we said that there's like a good and a bad versus like Gehenna, which was always negative. So how would you, I mean, I know we didn't even look at Gehenna like related to this, but just reading through it, I was kind of leaning more towards that idea versus like Hades and Sheol because of it being negative.
Yeah, it does seem. And the only case in the New Testament where it doesn't have, first of all, is it better? All right, from an Old Testament perspective, all right, let's, before we get to the New Testament and we find out things about paradise, generally speaking, in the Old Testament, is it better to be in Sheol or better to be alive? Generally speaking, it's better to be alive, right? You've got ideas, hints, sometimes some fairly clear statements that there's some good stuff that's going to happen there. All right. But it's ambiguous. When you get to the New Testament, you get some new ideas. All right. Where to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. Right. Today you will see me in paradise. All right. And so this, I think, is where there is a change. Right. And between in the Old Testament and the New, where you've got Sheol, as in the Old Testament, by and large, an undifferentiated whole. All right? The good go there, the bad go there. Okay? In the New Testament, you get a different idea where if this is all the places where the dead people can go to, there is a bad place. All right? There is a bad place. And it is called Hades. All right? But there's also another place, all right, which seems to be good. And paradise is apparently a very fitting term for that. Because, well, that's where Jesus says that guy is going to be whenever he dies. All right. Here's the question, all right, in terms of how we understand the biblical worldview. All right. Is the pit, all right, is the pit, because in Revelation, and in Luke, this seems to be the idea. Is the pit, because it has a negative connotation, is it to be equated with this, or is there a third, also bad place called the pit? And the pit is specifically a place for demons. Is it? I'm not sure. I'm not sure the data tells us, or at least I haven't seen anything. But you are absolutely right. In all cases, except for potentially Romans 10, all right, pit is always has a negative connotation. Demons don't want to go there, yet that's where they are, ultimately, when God decides to imprison them there. Right. The difference being, all right, the difference being Revelation 10, where it talks about Christ being brought up from the abyss. And here's the way language works, right? You can have a word, and this is why I start off with trunk. You can have a word, all right, that has multiple meanings, and you have to think about it contextually, all right? If you think about the word Hades, if you're willing to see that Hades can cover all of these ideas, all right? If that's the case, then you don't have to say Hades means X. You can say that Hades means X and Y, and you must look at context to determine, all right? Because that is a very normal thing you have to do in every single language that has ever existed on the earth, as far as I know. Not that I know them all, but generally speaking, this is a universal thing. Words in one language can point to different ideas. It's super common. It's not even unusual. As you probably know, it's super common. And so bringing Christ out of the abyss, all right, as we discussed before, I don't think Jesus was being tortured in hell whenever he died. I don't believe that's biblical at all. I think he was in a good place. He was with the thief in paradise. All right. The idea that, because I heard this when I was a kid, and so I latched onto it, right? The idea of the only way for our sins to be forgiven is if Jesus had to go to hell and be punished in hellfire for our sins, all right? I heard that when I was a kid. It's not there. All right? It's simply not there theologically. It's not there biblically. And so I think Jesus went to Hades. And I think it was a good place. It was a place of the dead. All right? But it was a good place. And it was there for 3 days. And then he left. Because he didn't belong there. Right? So I think that theologically is the case. And so I honestly don't know if these should be equated or just coupled, bifurcated, both bad, one for demonic, one for non. And ultimately, it doesn't matter a whole lot, right? Once you look at the evidence, you see that they are closely correlated. All right, you see that they are, of course, closely correlated. But you don't really need to make a decision on that, fortunately. All that makes sense? Word study is not easy. Well, sometimes word study is easy. I don't want to say it's not easy. Sometimes it is hard. And this is one of those where it is hard. Pit? Yeah. I'm pretty firm that it's one of these two. I'm 99.9%. It's one of these two. Because I've seen nothing to disagree with. I just don't know. Are they combined or separate things? Yes, Chip.
Is this a place that it's physical, but it represents a spiritual place. Hades is a spiritual place. Eden was a spiritual place in a way because God was there. And when he lived in heaven, he mm-hmm. put a spiritual being mm-hmm. at the entrance so they could help him back in. So,
yeah.
Kind of hard to separate the spiritual from the physical.
In the case of Eden, I do believe that Eden was actually a physical place, right? And that the spiritual and the physical were able to overlap, because God and demons are able to do that. Right? That's man cannot go from one place to the other, right? Just back and forth, right? It seems to be the ability of certain spiritual beings, including God, to do that. And so for God to be able, through perhaps a pre-incarnate, all right, ascension of Christ into the garden, can he do that and it still be physical? Yeah. I do believe Sheol is spiritual, all right? No matter how low you dig, you will not find Sheol, right? We know this now. They may not have known that. But then again, I do believe they viewed the spirit realm as a little different. Like, for example, Samuel, when he is evoked by the witch of Endor, is called a spiritual being. All right, he is a being of the spiritual realm when he is called up. He is no longer physical, and that separation has been made. That's an unusual thing to see in the Old Testament, but it does show up there. And so I know I don't believe Sheol is actually a physical place. I think it is specifically a spiritual place, which is why souls go there, which is why, and not bodies, and why ultimately demons, it makes sense to throw Satan and imprison him in the pit for a while. He's a spiritual realm being. Last question, Scoozy. We've got to be done.
Yeah, I was talking to one of my friends, and they have this idea where no one's been able to get into the core of the earth yet, for whatever mm-hmm. reason, and that's where Sheol is. What's your opinion on that?
No.
I mean, obviously.
That is my opinion on that.
Why? How would you disprove that idea?
How would I disprove that idea? One, when you think about the biblical theology of what Sheol is the separation of the soul from the body. All right. Does the body go down to Sheol? Sort of, at least in terms of image. All right. But when the body goes down to Sheol and dies, all right, when the person goes to Sheol, the body stays, 6 feet underground, not core of the earth. Generally speaking, though, I think the idea when you get to the New Testament, at least, is it really is a spiritual place. It is not the core of the earth. Now, if it's a great way to make movie plots, right? You dig down low enough, you will get bad things coming out to kill you. It's a great movie plot, right? But biblically speaking, we have no reason to think that is really the way I would say it. We have no reason to think it. And so therefore, it's an interesting idea, but it just doesn't fit. I can't disprove it, per se.
It just doesn't fit.
It just doesn't fit, because that is where spiritual beings go. I don't think that's necessarily the core of the planet. Yeah.
I know you said one more question. Perfect.
Okay.
When, I think it's Ecclesiastes that says the body goes back to dust,
mm-hmm.
the spirit goes back to God who gave it. Do you think that the spirit going back to God is going to Sheol?
That's a good question. I haven't thought about that one. Let me look it up, and we'll discuss it next time. Anything else? No, I'm not going to ask anything else. It's over. That is a good point of discussion. Yes, we will get to it. Okay, so that's it for today. Next time we will, I think we're probably done with Abyss at this point. Next time we will talk about some of the other terms that are in the document. Okay? Frank, will you pray for us, please?